Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and this week on the Roundup, we're going to be covering three key questions all international admissions offices are asking themselves these days. So for those of you who are new to the Roundup, I want to start by saying thank you for joining us. It's a really pleasure to come to you each week and have an opportunity to share our thoughts on what's going on in this crazy world we are in international education, and have an opportunity to talk to you today about some of the real key pieces of information that's coming down the pipe in terms of what's happening in international education that's being impacted, like all of us, in the world to really help all of us get a grip on what's going on in international education. So what the future might look like, because that's really the big unknown these days. And what we're going to do is this week, as we have for the last 3 weeks, we've changed the format slightly in that instead of just focusing on a particular news story or a particular event that's happened, we're going to talk to us, broaden the context a little bit about our discussions and really focus on some key questions, frankly, international admissions offices, international ed offices are grappling with at this time. We're going to talk today about three questions. First, what does this fall look like on campus? Is it going to be business as usual? Is it going to be something altogether different? Or are there four or five options that are currently on the table? We'll talk about what some of that looks like. We've talked over the last few weeks about test optional and covered the news on how many new institutions are joining the ranks of those that are becoming SAT, ACT test optional in one way or shape or form. I'm going to talk a little bit about that from a different perspective in terms of what that means for how students are evaluated at your institutions. Great article from a colleague of mine at ECE in Milwaukee. We'll go through some of the impact of that and how that's interpreted by many institutions around the country. And we'll finish up with a story on how international students that have been stuck in the United States, not able to return home, what they're doing for work and the relief that's now come from DHS to allow SSR, and we'll talk about that, about what that means for your students as well. But again, we'll jump into these three questions and see where you lie on these different issues. Love to get your feedback on that as we go forward. And as always, the news stories that we cover and highlight here on the Roundup are coming from our newsletter that comes out on Mondays each week. I just dropped the link to this past Monday's newsletter for all the SMIE news fit to share. And that's where we highlight both social media and international ed news, and then focus on three or four of the stories from the newsletter in this week's roundup, each week's roundup. So the newsletter is free to subscribe to, gets to your inbox 9 a.m. Eastern on Monday mornings. And then we cover three of those stories more in depth here on Wednesday. So it gives us a little bit of time to put all the pieces together and see how everything fits. Now let's get straight into the first question. What does fall look like for your campus this year? And if you guys have already had discussions on your home campus about what that looks like, what the options you're considering are, obviously it's too early to tell what state regulations will be, as it will be different in every state. Not everybody's going to have full and open access to all events as per usual. There'll be decisions made. Some institutions already have decided to go to 7-week terms. And I think the Chronicle article I've just posted the information to is from Beloit College. They're in this article, they're the first institution highlighted here. It's talking about for the fall, that they would be going to a later start date in the fall and 2 7-week modules instead of a full semester. So that way, if the college needed to move everyone online, much like they did this spring, either early or late in the fall, could do so with fewer disruptions. And that has been approved by their board and will be rolling out very shortly. So that's one institution. Obviously, there are 4,500 of these decisions that will still need to be made. Some of them will be system-wide for state and public universities, but others for privates will be on a per-case basis. We've talked about for what this fall might look like for some colleges is they may not exist anymore. We've just had, yesterday, a college here in Ohio, Urbana University, small D2 school, closed its doors permanently. They are, as of April 21st, they have closed their doors, will no longer be admitting students. So it is a very difficult time. Certainly Urbana University is not going to be the only one that will be closing. If anyone caught the Inside Higher Ed's presence survey results that were, the webinar was last week, but they, these results were actually gathered pre-COVID-19 pandemic when everybody started going online. The results of those survey were very telling. And in fact, 1 in 10 college presidents, when asked anonymously, that they could see their own colleges closing or merging within the next 5 years. And that was 1 in 10, so 10% of colleges closing. That'd be 450 schools could be closing in the next 5 years. There was other data in there that was pretty convincing to me. And then again, this is before all of the financial impact of COVID-19 has been realized and still isn't really fully realized until everybody brings in their class this fall or not. But we look at things like presidents that were in this survey were also asked, are they seriously considering discussing mergers or closures? Over 23% of private master's and doctorate level institutions were considering that. So almost 1 in 4 private universities were considering mergers or closures. 28% said that they were likely or should merge in the coming years just because of the financial pressures. And again, this is all the survey was done pre-COVID-19 pandemic. So what that tells me is there's something I certainly knew when I was on the campus side, that there are increasing pressures on institutions to maintain their programs, to maintain their status, to fund their institutions through primarily international students in a lot of cases, and what that has meant to the bottom lines and the operational procedures of those institutions, and how out-of-state students, international students became, do whatever you can to get them. We don't care where they come from, but let's have them on campus because that's going to help us, allow us to do the things we want to do programmatically on campus, financial aid-wise on campus, to improve the state of affairs for our institution. So that's what's happening, has been happening, but now we're faced with COVID-19 that changes the landscape entirely. And if you haven't thought about the consequences of what's happening, we're talking international education here because that's obviously at SMIE, that's what we're related to most directly. When you think about what's going to happen over the next 4 or 5 months, students right now are getting their I-20s from institutions that they've been admitted to, maybe had a deposit requirement. They, in the next month or two, typically 120 days out from the start of classes, whenever that is for you, that's the earliest date that those students can go to apply for a student visa. Those students now can't do that. Even if they had their I-20 in hand and it was within the 120 days, or it was day 120 before classes start, they cannot go physically to or online to apply for a visa interview because all embassies and consulates are closed and they are not allowing students to schedule their appointments. So you can fill out the forms, but you're not going to be able to schedule that appointment until after those embassies and consulates reopen and they can have the staffing necessary to go through any backlog, of which there'll be at least 2 months by the time they reopen. And there is no definitive date on when that is yet, but at least 2 months. So by the time students that you want to bring in the fall, unless they're already in the United States, not planning to go home for the summer break, and will be transferring from another institution to yours, unless you're in a fortunate position, and I know there are some of you out there who receive the majority of your new international students each year from domestic sources, unless you're in that fortunate situation, your international students coming from overseas are very unlikely to be able to get their visas in time to come for orientation. And that's in the best case scenario when you would have fully seated online as normal, in not online, on campus, full orientation on campus, some housing, all of that would be as normal. If we rewind the clock to January and started a new semester, you'd have all the ducks in a row there for new internationals to come in. That's the best case scenario. They're probably not going to get here in time. But even if they do, are you going to be having classes on your campus? Are those students that come in, and if they do enter the country and have a valid F1 visa, there are a lot of unknowns, obviously, not just on your campus, but in terms of immigration regulations. Will those new students, once they enter, if they're not physically able to be on campus to take classes because you've gone all online again for this fall term, what are you going to do for them? How early will you be able to know that information about whether you're going to be all on campus or online or some hybrid version of that, and be able to and let your prospective or incoming students know that's the case? And also, even if you can be all on campus, are they physically going to be able to get to you in time in order to start classes? And we don't know also if the extensions to the one course per term limit online that has existed for a number of years in immigration regulations that has been relaxed for the spring term for current internationals that were studying at your schools that went all online, that would have to be extended for the fall term in order for that to be practical for your institutions. So I would really be curious to find out from you what your perspectives are on where you're thinking along the terms, on the lines of what's possible at your institutions. What are you guys planning right now? So that's going to be a big one. So knowing what that looks like for you, it's going to be a real interesting mix of what a campus regulations or campus life might be like. And frankly, a lot of it is still out of your hands, own institutional hands, let alone your office's hands, because the state governments will be deciding regulations for how institutions, schools will reopen in the fall, and they're not there yet. We know that there are some. Boston University has come out and said that they're planning for, one of their options is planning for online only in the fall and reopen campus for January 2021. So that they were one of the early ones out there, and they got a lot of flack for that, but it's happening. You also, we'll talk more about it next week. We'll talk about what Purdue's plans are. They just released their plan yesterday. Their president, Mitch Daniels, former governor of the state, released their plans for actually going back on campus and having obviously a very large campus, 55,000 strong, what that looks like. But doing it in a way that 20 to 30% of their campus population, including faculty and staff and all that, are immunocompromised or in that high-risk group. And how do you do that compared to the students that are largely going to be less impacted by the effects of coronavirus at a lower percentage than the high-risk group? So they're looking at a very different way of opening campus in the fall, and we'll cover that next Wednesday on the roundup. So I'll be sure to be very interested in getting your feedback on that. So there's a lot of uncertainty, obviously, in terms of what's going to happen for your campuses right now, for your office, how that's going to operate, how your state is individually going to be responding to that. If you're in a state that's been in a hot spot for COVID-19, are the restrictions going to be eased later in the process, giving you time enough to, will there be enough time to make the decisions you need to open campus properly? Obviously, those decisions aren't at your pay level, and thankfully way above our own pay grades, but We certainly need to be aware of it, and we need to be able to communicate those effectively to our prospective international students that are already in the pipeline and looking for answers. I think we're all looking for answers right now as to what things are going to look like in the fall, but no one can say with any certainty that, yes, it's going to be open, yes, we're going to be online only, yes, it's going to be hybrid. No one knows for sure, but planning and being a part of those conversations is important, and I'm sure you're already thinking it if you haven't already. But there's a lot of ground to cover, obviously, before students enroll or arrive or not this fall. And we'll certainly have plenty more conversations about that in the coming weeks and months. So we'll shift gears now and get to the second topic for the week on what does test optional mean for international admissions. Now, if anyone who's watched the roundup or listened on the podcast, thank you for those of you who are subscribing and getting this on your devices each week. We appreciate that and happy to be a part of your day and week in international ed as you work from home, as we all are. I'm a big advocate of becoming test optional for international admissions, and there are a lot of reasons for that, which I won't go into now. But in terms of what being test optional actually means for you when you make that decision, as an institution, as an international office, to review international applicants without requiring an SAT or an ACT. What that means and what that requires you to do is to know your credentials backwards and forwards. And what does that look like? A good colleague of mine, Jack Nelson at Educational Credential Evaluators in Milwaukee, has written a nice article on the ECE News site, newsletter site. I've dropped the link to that in the comments section, and it's called "In a Test Optional World, When Does International Admissions Become an Educated Guess?" And some of us may feel like that if you've been in the business for more than a minute and have reviewed credentials on a regular basis and trying to interpret the differences in grading scales and what's an aggregated score and what's a traditional score. You know what we're talking about. So Jack, in his article, he talks about fairtesting.org mentions there, as we've talked about here, there are over 1,000 four-year schools that do not use SAT or ACT in admissions and have a searchable database there. The international ones is up to a little over 300, 330 now, taken out of the equation. So transcripts really become the sole gauge of a student's academic ability. And if you look at things, and this is my perspective, one of the many reasons I think test optional is the way to go, other than English language proficiency, where you do need a fairly standardized way of evaluating your prospective student's ability to speak English if you're a fully English language medium school, which you all would be in the US, is that you have to have a way of assessing the academic ability. And too many institutions, for my benefit, use test scores as their crutch to compare apples to apples, what they think are apples to apples, in terms of students' ability on verbal, mathematics, writing, reading, whatever the case may be, for SAT, ACT, science even, for ACT. So those are what they think are apples to apples, but the reality is it's apples to oranges. And again, we won't go into all the deep reasons why, but international students being asked to be assessed compared to a U.S. applicant who has studied American English their entire lives, perhaps all only gone to an American high school in the United States, that is a very different ability set necessarily related to English and math than an international student who probably learned British English. But beside the point here, if you make the decision to take international, take SATs or ACTs off the table for international students, the academic ability question is based almost exclusively on their academic transcripts from their secondary school, if we're talking about freshman admissions or first-year student admissions, or their bachelor's degree work if you're looking at graduate admissions. So obviously, if that's all you're using, you want to make sure your credential evaluation service that you're using, if it's an external one, or if it's you've got all that expertise in-house in terms of resources you have, if you're relying on ACRO, other sources, Education USA, their country fact sheets, all of those kinds of things, if you're going that route for being test optional, what do you have all the resources you need to evaluate each transcript you're seeing effectively? Do you know the differences in the different cantons in China, or different provinces in China in terms of the way they their grading scales? Are you aware of the grading scales in an international unit of a high school versus a standard high school and a domestic-based high school in China, or the standard 10 and 12s in India? Are you familiar with how those exams fit compared to the school records? So knowing all of that, and Jack points out a great example in South Korea. They have secondary transcripts may include two sets of grades, one based on an aggregate marks and one based on rank relative to other students. And so if you're not familiar with the differences there, are you going to be able to assess that student effectively compared to your grading scale at your institution and make an informed decision? What about the West African Exam Council's exams? Are you able to know how to get the right scores and verify those scores and have an understanding of how those impact compared to what your standards would be? So I do want to give a shout out to Jack because he really does a great job in the article in terms of highlighting the educational resources, the credential evaluation resources you need to have in-house if you're doing this your own way, or the kinds of things you want to make sure if you're using a different service like ECE or one of the other providers, if you're using another service, that they're in line with what your institution's thinking is regarding particularly this more impactful at the graduate level regarding maybe 3-year degrees from India, if those would qualify for entry into a master's program or not. So those are things that you certainly want to be thinking about. And I mentioned this test optional piece as an example because a lot of the recent rush to become test optional over the last 2 months, you've seen a lot of it being driven by, the March, April, May, and maybe June ACT and SAT test dates are being canceled. Well, now SAT and ACT now have these at-home editions. At least SAT does. I don't know if I've seen one for ACT. But having these at-home editions to potentially replace that. There are still some schools that have always required SAT or ACT that are not making exceptions because for their 2021 class, because they still think that there are going to be plenty of opportunities for those rising seniors to take the exams and then satisfy the requirements of that institution. So still some Ivy Leagues in that position and other elite schools that will not be waiving those test scores, particularly even for international students. So there's real expediency that's been driving a lot of these institutions that have said, okay, we're going test optional for the next year, but we're not going to do it beyond that. So we're not committing to it beyond that. But you then have schools like, interesting to see, and I've just posted the link to it, Brandeis has recently gone completely test optional. And this has just been posted on their website in the last couple of weeks that they are no longer requiring any applicants other than homeschool applicants and GED recipients. Those are the only two that are still required to submit standardized test scores. So they've included internationals in who are now test optional. So very encouraged by that. I want a more selective school like Brandeis to make that step. So that's certainly, I think, a very positive thing. So congrats to Carlos and the folks at Brandeis for making that important move. So congrats there. A number of other schools, Pepperdine has always been test optional for internationals, but they're they're ones that have added domestic to that population, or a number of others that are doing that on a more permanent basis. So encouraging to see some of this happening. As we've talked about here, it's not something that I've been a big fan of, but certainly one where I see that there's a new movement that's some based on expediency and circumstances, but some of are using this as a way to make this situation permanent. And I hope more colleges will jump on this bandwagon, because as Jack points out in his article again, it's so important that if you do make that jump, and which I encourage you to do, that you include and beef up and make sure you have the credential evaluation resources, whether in-house or using a provider, service provider like an ECE that knows their stuff. and is really in line with where your institution is in terms of grading policies and that type of thing. So test optional doesn't come without consequences, and that credential evaluation piece is absolutely essential and when we're looking at international candidates. So good luck with those decisions. Final piece that we'll end with today is another bit of relief. I'm surprised it's taken this long to happen, but for those who are international student advisors that have been grappling with these issues, along with the online courses that students have been taking since campuses closed, since those that were able to get home to their home countries still taking online classes, being able to return invalid status and not losing ground. Not having to reapply. But one of the ones for those, one of the pieces of international student life that's a real issue right now, as it has been in the past, whenever there's been major catastrophes in certain countries, whether it's earthquakes in Nepal or Turkey or other cases, Haiti has also been impacted by this in the past. International students can get what they call special student relief. And this SSR, as they call it, allows international students who are in valid F1 status that if they are experiencing emergent circumstances in terms of back in their home countries, or the person who's responsible for their funding has economic challenges in one way or another, and who doesn't have an economic challenge these days, that international student advisors can apply for them to have special student relief, SSR, that suspends the regulations that require international students while classes in session to work only on campus and only 20 hours per week. With SSR, international students who have this permission from their designated school official can work off campus. And that's something that allows them potentially earn higher level wages than they are able to earn on campus. So it's something that is an important benefit that is now being extended to international students that are facing that economic hardship, that they can apply for that off-campus work permission without penalty. So that's encouraging and a bit of bright light on what's happening. Certainly there's more to come on the immigration side, and we'll talk next week about what NAFSA's been proposing to Homeland Security about what regulations and to Department of State as well for visa processing, what some helpful steps that can be put in place to ease the transition in this very chaotic period between now and the time student classes resume in the fall. So we'll take a look at that more in depth next time, but good to see this SSR getting approved by immigration, by U.S. Customs and Enforcement Immigration Services. So encouraging to see that, but most of all, encouraged that you're still with us and you're battling on, you're fighting the good fight on your campuses, and hopefully enjoying the time at home with friends and family that you are at home with. We look forward to continuing these discussions in the weeks to come, and wish you all the best, and look forward to hearing from you in the days and weeks to come. Have a wonderful day. Cheers.